Blog Talk Radio.
Are you ready for more propaganda? Well, you're in the wrong place at the right time. Columbo Chronicles is for critical thinkers. Let's welcome the consumer advocate for justice. Here's the Rose, Rose Columbo.
Hi, everyone. It's the Rose, Rose Columbo, right here for you.
The Justice Club is back on Columbo Chronicles live podcast. Join Rose Columbo at noon and find out what tips she will provide in a world of little justice.
That's right. Find out what we are going to discuss on the Justice Club in part two. And today we have a wonderful returning guest, and he will be joining us in just a little bit. He is the author of Room Full of Killers, and his name is Preston Rendell. He is a three-time award-winning author, and he is a Mr. Universe, a Mr. USA, and he has written for fitness magazines for the last 20 years. The magazines include Muscle Mag International, Planet Muscle, and Natural Physique. His subjects include training, nutrition, historical subjects, interviews, and humor articles as well. He took 2 years off to write his current novel, Room Full of Killers. Mr. Rendell has previously written a book called Health Nuts on Cape Cod, which we discussed here on Columbo Chronicles Live in the past, and it is a wonderful, humorous book as well. In 1964, he owned and operated the third health club in Massachusetts called President City Health Club, and it was in Quincy and the second health club on Cape Cod. It was called Preston's Health Spa in Hyannis, Massachusetts. Along the way, he won Mr. USA and as a natural in Kansas City and placed second as Mr. Universe as a natural in Las Vegas. And the reason I point out the natural is because Preston is a strong advocate for steroid-free sports and would like to think he was a catalyst in the fitness health boom in Massachusetts. The story is exciting because he lived in Boston's Italian North End, Mamma Mia, and he trained and boxed out of the New Garden Gym on Friend Street and the University Gym in the South End. So we're just going to get started in a moment and introduce you to Preston Rendell right after this important message. So don't touch that dial.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure. Be sure to bring your appetite.
That's right. Be sure to bring your appetite to the Horseshoe Cafe.
Obamasaurus, the new book by Rose M. Colombo, is an updated version of a political satire that reflects the political roadmap of today's world. Written with an Orwellian twist, will humanity survive or suffer depopulation or extinction? Obamasaurus by Rose M. Colombo, available at Amazon.com.
Columbo Chronicles Live. Columbo is on their trail. Listen up at Columbo Chronicles Live.
That's right. Listen up, because we're about to enter into the world of authors and experts with an exciting guest, Preston Rendell, right off the East Coast, and a good old Italian paisan. And let's say buongiorno to our very, very special guest.
Whoa.
Hi, Preston. Buongiorno. Hello. How are you?
Pretty good.
Oh, good. You sound good. It's good to have you back on the show, as always. And, you know, your book, Room Full of Killers. Oh, thanks. And your book, Room Full of Killers, hey, it is probably going to be seen on the, I predict, on the silver screen one day. And it's an exciting book. And so are you looking forward to writing the second version, or is this going to be just a one version book?
No, I have a bunch of ideas. I have a ton of stuff already down for the second book.
Oh, I think that's fantastic. So tell us, Preston, tell us a little bit about your background that led you to wanting to write a book in the first place.
Well, I got involved in boxing in Boston. And I was telling my female friend all these crazy, funny stories over the years. And at that particular time, I was writing for fitness magazines. And I was voted best writer of training and nutrition articles. So I'm telling all these funny, funny stories. And she said, why don't you write a book about it? I said, why didn't I think of that? So I sat down for, it's true story, so I sat down for 2.5 years, 8 hours, 6 to 8 hours a day, without a day off, for 2.5 years, and I wrote this book. It came out to 750 pages, which is way too long to submit to a publisher. They only want like 300 words. So I had two people edit it down to 535 pages. And it's getting rave reviews from people who read it.
Yeah, because it's a page turner. You have to know what happened next. But before we get into the book, tell us about your childhood for those who don't know about your childhood, because we always have new listeners.
Well, I was a sickly kid, believe it or not. I had asthma, so much so that my parents took me to a specialist all over New England. And they had no resolution for it. So some reason I got involved in bodybuilding because I weighed about 85 pounds. I was the skinniest kid in the town, which happens with asthmatics. So I got involved in bodybuilding to put some weight on. And I started putting weight on like crazy, which was very exciting to me. And then my whole world was just bodybuilding, bodybuilding. And I got up to some serious size. And I got up to 6 feet, 215. It was pretty big, but no drugs. And then Sonny Liston and Cassius Clay came to Boston to box. So I went to see them both train. And I saw Liston train in a town called Plymouth, which you probably have heard of, as Mayflower and Pilgrims and all that stuff. It was a real exclusive country club there, and he trained at it. I went over to see him, and they were charging, I think it was $5 a head to get in and see him. Everybody was dressed like they were going out to a nightclub. It was unbelievable, male and female. And it was quite a show. Liston put on quite a show. So the next day I went in to see Cassius Clay train. He was in Boston. There was no cover charge. And I went in, and I don't think there was a dozen people in there. And he was the champion of the world at that time. And I walked over and leaned against the ring that he was training at. That's how empty it was. And I watched him shadow box train, this and that, and then spar. So I decided at one point, I said, I'm as big as almost Wilson. And I'm as strong as him, and I'm a pretty good athlete, and I'm a very fast runner. And I said, I should give it a shot to see what's going on, because they were getting $1 million each for that fight. And I said, well, $1 million each isn't too bad. So I started training in Boston in a French Street gym. And that's kind of where my story starts. I moved into the North End, which is 100% Italian then. And you had to be Italian to move in there. They wouldn't let you move in unless you're Italian. And it's true. You wouldn't get in there. You didn't even drive through. You didn't even drive through there. They had their own. They had their own police. And
they did.
It's just the way it was, you know. So anyway, when I got in there, little did I know there was a mob war going on, and bodies showing up everywhere for control of the rackets. And everybody, I'm going to get involved in boxing, which is nothing but a racket, you know. And I got involved in a lot of stuff. And that's what I started telling my female friend. She said, put this down, write a book about it. So I did.
Yeah, you did. So tell us, who are your main characters in the book?
Main characters, the male is Gianni Valentino Romasco. Romasco was my mother's maiden name. And Valentino was because my grandmother was that's my mother's mother. She was insane about Rudolph Valentino. Her husband died in 1931 or two or something. She said the only way she would have remarried is if would have been Valentino.
That's funny.
He
story.
Died young too. It's true story. And
I believe
of
it.
Of course, every woman in the world wanted to be with Valentino, but he died young.
He's a great lover.
I think he was in his 20s when he died. But
really?
Yeah, Valentino. I can't remember where he died. Oh, he died of ruptured appendix.
That's interesting.
That was in the 20s.
Yeah, back.
When I saw it happened.
So Grandma wanted to marry Valentino. So that's how you got the name Valentino in part of your character's name.
Yeah. And Gianni, which is Italian, is for John.
Mm-hmm.
So the other characters is Anna Piscatelli, and let's see who else. Roy Romasco is in it. That's my father.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother, Rita Romasco. My grandmother, Nina Romasco, is in it. And all of my Italian relatives, just about.
That makes for a colorful situation if they're anything like my Italian family, and I'm sure they are very similar, they all are, and that makes for a very colorful movie, very colorful book, and very colorful characters as well, right?
Yeah, my mother played the piano every day of her life and sang.
Mm-hmm.
On Sundays, she played classical music. She played Chopin on Sundays.
Wow,
but
that's amazing.
That's where we lived. My
mm-hmm.
father was a jazz musician.
I don't think you told us about that. Yeah.
He was a jazz musician. He played with Glenn Miller. I don't know if you heard of Glenn Miller.
Oh, my goodness.
And my mother's brother, his name was John Romasco. But he sang under the name, he was a singer, he sang under the name Jack Whiting. He sang with a big band here in New England. And my mother was following him, and that's how she met my father, because my father played in the same band as my uncle.
Oh,
That's how they hooked up.
Wow, that's a great story.
True story.
So then, yeah. So what happened once you went and you watched the champions of the world and practicing their boxing and training? Yeah. So what did you do after that to get involved in boxing?
Well, I went to a gym in Boston called the Friend Street Gym. That was the big gym in Boston. There was a lot of champions from came out of there. One of them was Tony DeMarco, who was a world champion in the mid-50s. He was from the North End also. He was a god in the North End. But I went to that gym. It started working out. Then I got involved with amateurs and fighting, and it all starts, all the crooked stuff. Jeez.
So did you have to get an agent?
No. No, you got to get a manager, a trainer.
A manager? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then he took care of your...
Yeah,
and then he took care of all of your events after that?
Supposedly, yeah. Yeah.
And so what are some of the things you experienced in your book during that time?
Well, one of them was I had about four or five fights, and I was approaching the gym by this guy named Paul Stivaletta, who wanted me to fight an exhibition fight with his fighter in an outside venue in the suburbs of Boston in a couple of weeks. So I said, okay. And my father and I and my brother went out, and we get to the places where we go through the woods and everything, and it opens up. It was called the Finn and Fur Club. It was in Norwood, Mass. And we get there, and there's all kinds of, there's nothing, it's like remote. Then you get big opening in the woods, and there's all kinds of cars, Boston TV, vans. I said, what the hell's going on here? It's just an exhibition. So anyway, they had about four or five exhibitions, which were just three rounds each. Then I was the last one because I was heavyweight, I guess. And I was going to box this guy who was training with Paul Stivaletta. And I got in a ring, started, and it's supposed to be an exhibition where you don't kill him, you just box and move around a little, you know. But this kid, his name was Paul Doyle, I'll never forget it, he came out like a hurricane, throwing at him bombs at me. So I... at a hold at one point, and I said, hey, this is an exhibition. What are you doing? He didn't even hear me. He just kept doing it. I said, holy mackerel. So, yeah, true story. He was trying to take my head off.
Wow.
So So I hit him with a real hard right hand and knocked him down. I think I broke his nose. I'm not sure. And he beat the count. He was up, and then we went at it again. The round ends, and I go to my corner. And there's a guy in the corner was Paul Stivaletta, but when I went back to the corner, he wasn't there. There's a guy named Carmine. A little town guy says, I kid. I said, where's Paul? He's just relax, kid. Everything's all right, you know, just relax. So anyway, I go for the second round. Third round is supposed to end. So go back at the end of the third round, and he said, Carmine says, there's another round. It's supposed to be three. It turns out it was four and five round. The fifth round was like, it was supposed to be 3 minutes. The fifth round was about 6 minutes long. They're trying to drown me, as they say in the business, which means take you out in the deep water so you drowned. And anyway, I went and made it through. You know, because you're just a young kid training. You can't fight that length of time without... running out of gas, you know. So the fight ended. I went back to my car, and I was bullshit. My father and my brother came over, and I said, what's going on? I said, Paul Civiletta, after you knocked the guy down the first round, he went over the other guy's corner. I said, what? He said, you see all these TV trucks and the people? And he said, they're going to film him because he's going to turn pro in another week. And he's undefeated amateur with like 24 fights. And they wanted to be a big, big springboard to take your head off. And I said, I only had three fights or something, four fights. And anyway, that's why he set me up for that. And didn't happen. There was the referee for the fight was a guy named Paul Pender, who was a middleweight champion of the world. He beat Sugar Ray Robinson twice. Of course, Robinson was older than him, but he still beat him two decisions in Boston. At the end of the fight, he said to me, Paul Pender said to me, when you turn pro kid, let me know because I want to train you. Manager, blah, blah, blah. So I was pretty flattered. So I told my father afterwards, and my father said, yeah, he's been drinking. I said, so what? But anyway, I never did hook up with Paul. I wish I did. But anyway, that's how I started. Then it just evolved into story after story after story.
Well, that must have been a real shocker to you when you were young and they're telling you, you know, you're just going to hop three rounds and it's over, and then to set you up with this guy that they're actually promoting. How did that affect you emotionally from that point on?
I didn't trust anybody.
Yeah.
From that on. But I was told that in the beginning, watch out for all the vampires.
When you're young, you're so trusting, you know, when you think people have your best interest, even as you get older. But, you know, most of the time you find out that they have their best interest at heart, not yours. So
True. How
did you overcome that?
I just stuck with it. You know, and of course I had that story in the back of my mind, which I do resolve in the book. And Paul Civiletta is actually Paul Armani in my book. And he's in the whole book right up until the last couple of chapters. So he gets busted. I don't want to give it away too much, but...
No, you don't want to give away too much, but it's interesting to find out your thoughts and how, you know, a young person gets caught up in this world. And you can make a lot of money, I assume, but then again, I think you could probably be used and abused and lose a lot of money that should go to you and ends up going to them, which happens in a lot of different careers. So, did you get another agent? Trainer, let's say, manager, trainer?
Yeah, I did. A guy named, in the book, he's Bad Mike Brown, but his real name is Johnny Two Heads. He was a fighter in Boston, black guy, and he was a killer. Where he walked, flowers grew. He was one tough guy.
So did you start to win fights, or were you finding it tough? Yeah.
Yeah, I was undefeated, and then I didn't have a ton of fights. I only had 17 fights, but they were spaced out. Mm-hmm. So I was training in the gym with professionals, and every time I trained with professionals, it was like a war in the gym, you know. Because, you know, like I was on a job training, but I still had some, I never had a really easy fight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all I did, I knocked a couple of guys out quickly. But I never really had an easy fight, as they say. You know, I was never given a setup. The same with Marciano. They stuck him in with the Wolves. Marciano, every fight, he beat them all.
So it's really competitive, and then there's all this outside deals going on, it sounds like, and they could be for you or against you and you won't even know at the time and until it's over with. So did you find it to be financially beneficial to you, or did you find that you needed to find another way out to survive?
Oh, I had a job. I worked in computers.
Oh, you did?
And a model for Ford agency as well. $40 an hour. That was back in the 60s. It was a lot of money.
Yes. So when did you decide to compete in the Mr. Universe and the Mr. USA and
I got out of boxing after all of that. Mostly because I found out that everybody in boxing in Boston, nobody made any money except the managers and the promoters. Everybody else made nothing. I couldn't name me one fighter in Boston that walked away with maybe Marvin Hagler did, but I never heard of anybody say he retired wealthy, a fighter. I never did. I never knew any. So most of them wound up getting jobs afterwards, you know, regular jobs. So
what about Muhammad Ali? Did you actually ever personally contact him, or did you just watch him train?
Well, the interesting thing is I saw him. He came back in a box, Boston. When he refused to go in the draft, they took his title away from him, and he was going around the country giving exhibitions to make money. So he came into Boston to have an exhibition in Conley's gym in the South End. It's all Irish. The North End was all Italian, and the South End was all Irish. Conley's gym was in the South End. And Ali was sparring in there with different guys in the ring. And he'd be, so Johnny, my manager, Johnny, and I went over to, I can't say enough about Johnny either. He was something else. He was a big guy, 6'3", 215 or so. He had fists the size of bricks. And he had an 80-8 record. And the mob wanted him to sign with him. He wouldn't, so he didn't get title shots. But he made a cover of Ring magazine in the 50s. So he got robbed. But anyway, he wanted to spar with Ali, as all these other guys were. So he and I went to the gym. And the boxing gym is, you know, set up, and he's sparring with different guys. And Johnny is out in the crowd, and he's got his workout gear on. He's hitting a body bag. Just big boom, boom, but huge noise when he hits it. So Ali's in the ring, and he's telling his stories about him and how wonderful he is, and they can beat anyone, and blah, 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 blah. And at one point, Johnny hit the body bag, which is a big, big, like 50-pound bag. And he hit it with a left hook, and the thing was chained, big chain length into a wooden beam in the ceiling. He hit it with a left hook and tore the chain out of the ceiling.
Oh, wow.
And the bag fell on the ground. Now, everybody stopped and turned around and looked at Johnny. And somebody said to Ali, he said, you want to spar with him? Ali says, what do you think, I'm crazy? True story.
That's a great story. Oh, thanks for telling that. That's a great story. I love it. But so tell us, you know, there must have been like moments when your parents were concerned about you being in a ring and, you know, not knowing about, you know, because we hear stories about people having brain concussions and all of that. So
well,
I'm sure your parents were.
Well,
your
my
mother?
My mother had passed away by then.
Oh,
and my father
okay.
was very anxious to for me to pursue it. Why, I don't know.
Oh.
But my mother had passed away. In the book, she's well, alive and well, but not in reality, she had died.
Oh, I see. And so then, what did you find to be the most threatening or frightening moments? Because at that time, there was a lot of crazy things going on in this country with the mafia and different mafias. I mean, Irish, Italian, Chinese, all kinds of mafias there are. So what did you find the most frightening to be while you were
who,
in the...
You didn't know who to trust. You didn't know
okay.
who to trust or who to believe. There was a fighter in Boston named Irish Al Kivlin. He was supposed to take it easy on a fighter from New York, and he beat the guy up bad. And next time he fought in Boston, they brought in a guy from New York who demolished him. And they gave him a fake record, you know. They demolished him. And,
wow.
And there was another fighter. Actually, it was a trainer. I can't remember his name. A little black guy, nice guy. He just, everybody, I spoke to a guy about 15 years later. I said, whatever happened to him? He said, he just disappeared. He did something. He just disappeared out of the gym.
That happened.
It was
today,
every
too.
Single day. All of a sudden, he just disappeared.
Wow.
You know?
I'm so glad you wrote this book because it just goes to show, you know, that how vulnerable people are to people who become promoters and so forth, and then you could end up in so many different situations that
John King
it's amazing.
Supposedly robbed everybody.
Who did?
He robbed Ali. He robbed everybody.
Don really?
King. Oh, awful.
Oh.
James Buster Douglas got a $20 million offer to fight Mike Tyson. This was like 1992 or something. And he beat Tyson. It was like 40-1 odds or something. And he knocked out Tyson. And he got $100,000 for the fight after expenses. Don King. That's called creative
wow.
bookkeeping. Creative bookkeeping. Can you
wow.
imagine?
Creative bookkeeping. Yeah, there's a lot of that.
$20 million. They whittled it down to $100,000.
Holy smoke. Yeah. You know, money comes and money goes really fast.
Oh, yeah.
In all kinds of situations. So,
yeah.
What was it like? Did you love living in the Italian neighborhood? And
oh, I loved it. I used to wake up every morning. I used to wake up every morning to bread.
Mm.
So it was all bakeries, you know. And in the morning, that's when they cooked, and the whole place just permeated with homemade bread. And the restaurants were unbelievable. It was just a swarm of restaurants everywhere.
Oh yeah, and my dad's friends. And I went to school with his daughter at a Catholic school, the Galassos, and they had a Italian bakery. And every Saturday morning, they'd call my dad and say to come on down because they were going to be taking the bread out in 15 minutes. So he'd always bring me, and we'd go in the car and go into their bakery. And oh, everything was fantastic. And the bread was, it was wonderful. And so we buy the bread and the olives and the sausage and the cheese and all that. And on the way home, me and my dad, we couldn't resist. We're eating the hot bread with the salami on the way home. My mom would always go, "What happened to the bread?" You can't resist
sure.
it, right? It's amazing, and you never forget. Then my uncle.
Yep.
Frankie Colombo bought the Colombo's Bakery in Los Angeles, but he passed away, and probably it's sold now. But yeah, so yeah, it's kind of it's bread is like really warm and homey, and the fragrance of the bread when it's baking, it just makes people feel good, right?
Yeah, yeah. There's a place in Framingham where I originally lived, and I moved to Boston. There's a place in Framingham called Framingham Bakery. It was 100% Italian bakery. And every Saturday, the people from five towns away came there and just robbed the place, just emptied everything out of there.
Yeah, well, they're still making Galasso's bread, so, you know.
Pizza, bread, everything.
Yeah, you can't, you can't let a good thing go to waste.
Framingham Bakery's on Facebook, and people on there are saying it's the best pizza I've ever. They're still raving about it. I was going there 40 years ago.
So you have wonderful stories in your book, Room Full of Killers, Preston Rendell. And can you tell us just a short clip of whether it's romance or corruption or something happy or funny, what would be your best little clip you can give us that you like yourself personally from your book?
Oh, boy. I think it was the title fight, which was when Johnny Romasco was drugged in his first title fight, and then they had a rematch, and he got drugged in the second fight.
Wow!
But Johnny Two Heads, who at this point was in the hospital because they tried to murder him to take over Gianni's contract. A mob wanted to kill Johnny, so Johnny would sign with the mob. But Johnny was half Cree Indian, which is Canadian. Canadian Cree Indian. And he spotted how he was getting drugged, and he was a Cree Indian, and he gave the people what was going on from the hospital room in sign language, what was going on. That was probably the best part of the best part of the book.
Oh, wow.
He solved how they were doing it, and he couldn't tell anybody because he got shot pretty bad, and he was incommunicado, I guess. But he told him in Cree sign language, and he had his cousin there. He was an Indian. He told everybody, and that the guy related to the people in the fight was going on the second fight, and Johnny told him how to get out of that and how to nullify or neutralize the drugs, which he did, and he won the fight.
Oh my God, that is such a fantastic story. I really hope your book gets made into a movie, because it's really exciting for men and women, and it has human interest in it, and stories that people would never normally know about, because you took the time to write.
Unique.
Yes, it is, and you took the time to and effort and.
Where do you see how he did it?
Oh boy. And so, Preston, what about your writing with magazines? Do you still write for the sports magazines? Because you were
I did that for three-time
winner.
Yeah, I was a three-time, probably the best for 3 years, best writer of training and nutrition articles. I was writing for four different magazines, four of the top bodybuilding magazines in the world. And computers came in, and the stuff was online, and then the business dried up. But for 20 years, I was writing for four magazines at once. I got three.
Yeah, the internet. Internet did a lot.
Yeah, I got three-ring binders. Three books, with three rings. and packed full of articles that I wrote. I wrote for Muscle Mag International, which is the second biggest bodybuilding magazine in the world. I wrote for Iron Man, Natural Physique. What the hell was that? Oh, the other one was Planet Fitness. It was Jeff Everson's book. I wrote for him.
That's amazing. I'm so glad you're my friend and my guest today, and because I love your book, I love your story, and you are a fantastic person on top of it all. So if you were to, I know you have hot romance in here too, just so everyone knows.
Oh, yeah.
It's not a story with the mafioso that without romance.
I got a woman from New Jersey named Eileen Zuccato. She wrote me on Facebook. She said, I got your book. She said, I read it when I was changing my grandson. I read it when I was cooking dinner. I read it when I was doing the laundry. She said, I couldn't put it down. She says, the best book I ever read in my life.
That's fantastic. And you know, that's a compliment. That's a huge compliment when people can't put your book down.
Oh, yeah. I got an email from a guy who said the same thing.
Oh, I believe that. I'm sure you have tons of them.
I just want to tell you, blah, blah, blah. I put the email on my Facebook page.
I save all mine in a binder like you do because they're important that people would take the time to write to you or send you, you know, their thoughts, you know. And so I save them because that's special when people do that. And so, well, I think we'll probably be looking for your next book as well. But in the meantime, can you share with us any messages you want with our audience? And, and don't forget to send me your phone number. I think I wrote it down wrong, just on a personal note. But anyway,
okay.
can you share with us your thoughts that you would like to share about your book or your fitness and nutrition tips, as well as, of course, where they can find you online and buy your book?
And my book's on Amazon. And I wrote the name of my book is Room Full of Killers. And there's another book out there called A Room Full of Killers. The guy put it out. I think he was trying to draw off my book. But it's not my book, just Room Full of Killers with my name, Preston Rendell. That's what it's available from. And it's selling really well. I'd like to get a literary agent, which is very tough to do. But that's my next move. I got a couple of people I'm interested in, what's the word, hawking it to. Stallone, Ron Howard, and there's a third one. I can't think of the third one. And to make it a movie. Oh, I know. Martin Scorsese. I'm trying to get a hold of him.
Mm-hmm.
There's a thing I get every day in the mail. It says, contact any celebrity. Now, I was going to ask you if you know anything about it.
Oh, they've been around a long time. But generally, celebrities you're either introduced to, but you can't promote yourself to them because then they think that's all you want from them. So it's always best to get a buffer, which is an agent who you can hopefully trust and give it your best shot and have them present your book. I can send you information on a couple agencies that you might want to contact. And, because really and truly it's the personal thing unless you're connected and you get a piece of luck somewhere along the way with it. Generally, they're not going to read anything other than if it comes through an agent. And it's probably better that way anyway because they know how to speak to them. They know how to push it. They know how to promote it.
Right.
you know, and you have to really know what you're saying to them, how what your hook is, and you better be on the ball when you talk to them, you know, because they don't want to listen to a long story. They don't care. They just want it quick and fast, and an agent can do that really fast. I mean, you can do it too, but you still need to do the synopsis and all that stuff and your portfolio for the agent, you know what I'm saying. But I will get, I'll get back with you on that too. And hopefully don't pick just any agent. You have to check them out because you have to make sure they're reputable and they're not going to be like the managers and trainers in the boxing, the boxing sports arena. So, yeah, I'll send you some information and email me your phone number because I think I wrote it down wrong for some reason in my new book. I had it, but then I rewrote it, and I think I put one number wrong. So I am so happy for you because you deserve to have people read this book, I believe. And so, and I'm not just saying that. I mean it. It's intriguing. It's totally intriguing and fascinating. So I wish you the best, and I really thank you for taking the time to speak to our audience today and share your information and your short clips on what is happening in your book and in your story that should cause people to go to Amazon.com and type in Room Full of Killers by Preston Rendell, R-E-N-D-E-L-L. And on that note, I just thank you so much, Preston, and you have a great rest of the day. Thanks for being on Columbo Chronicles Live.
Thank you, and you have a good day yourself.
Thanks, Preston. I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
And Preston Rendell has left the building, and what a great book, and Room Full of Killers. And so on that note, we'll take a break. And when we come back, I will enter into the Justice Club.
Obamasaurus, the new book by Rose M. Colombo, is an updated version of a political satire that reflects the political roadmap of today's world. Written with an Orwellian twist, will humanity survive or suffer depopulation or extinction? Obamasaurus by Rose M. Colombo, available at Amazon.com.
The Justice Club is back on Columbo Chronicles Live Podcast. Join Rose Columbo at noon and find out what tips she will provide in a world of little justice.
Columbo Chronicles Live. Columbo is on their trail. Listen up at Columbo Chronicles Live.
Listen up because we have a little bit of time here to talk about the Justice Club. What is in the Justice Club is the Secret Service agents reportedly willing to testify to that Trump did not lunge at him. That would mean that the woman who testified at the January 6th hearings may have not been 100% honest or maybe delusional. Who knows? So senior Secret Service agents are reportedly prepared to testify that Donald Trump did not lunge for the wheel of his vehicle. I can't even imagine Donald Trump doing that. So I'm sorry if I'm laughing because it seems so ridiculous. Or physically attacked the chief of a security detail after his speech near the White House on January 6th. As a former aide said he did in sworn testimony on Tuesday. How honest is sworn testimony? Seriously, this is like, I mean, I'm sorry I'm laughing, but this is such a ridiculous statement because it makes no sense. So anyway, the row follows the explosive testimony by the House January 6th committee, which painted, and I watched speech, and I watched Donald Trump, and he was anything but unhinged at the Capitol building. when he was speaking to the supporters at the rally, which painted an unhinged and violent portrait of Trump on the day of the Capitol attack. In a shocking hearing, many... Now, I've seen Representative Maxine Waters and Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the squad become very angry and appear to be out of control when they say get in the face of every Trump supporter and approach him, as they did with Senator Rand Paul and his wife when they were walking out of one of the government buildings from a hearing, and they had to seek out police protection from BLM and Antifa, who were bullying them and taunting them, and they felt threatened, and they weren't arrested then. So this is not a two-way street any longer or a two-party system. It is a one-party system, their way or the highway. CNN and other outlets reported the pushback on the alleged Secret Service incident from Tony Ornato, who is also a deputy chief of staff in the Trump White House, and Robert Engel, who is Trump's security chief. Separately on Wednesday, Liz Cheney, the neocon, the Republican Committee vice chair, calls for Trump's White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, to testify. I wish that Liz Cheney would actually investigate the Iraq and Afghanistan wars and how it cost the American people $6 trillion plus, and we're still paying for it, and that it racked up from $8 billion to $6 trillion in national debt, and how Halliburton, who was bankrupt from all the lawsuits for asbestos, which are still going on today, was going under until they got the no-bid contract to go into Afghanistan and Iraq and became a multi-billion dollar business. That's what I would like to find out about. What about you? So Cheney said, as we heard yesterday, oh, and that doesn't even count for all the thousands of injuries and deaths and amputees and those who are still in veterans' hospitals suffering from their injuries. Serious injuries that left them in a terrible situation for themselves and their families. So, as we heard yesterday at the J6 hearings, it says, Cheney said, Pat Cipollone had significant concerns regarding Trump's January 6 activities. It's time for Cipollone to testify on the record. Any concerns he has about the institutional interests of his prior office are outweighed by the need of his testimony. And just today we heard that, at least I heard today, that Michael Stengel, who was the sergeant at arms for the Capitol building on January 6th, suddenly died the day before he was to testify at the hearing. It's amazing how many people die or disappear or have accidents before certain hearings or court cases. It's amazing, absolutely amazing. I guess it all remains a mystery. So on Tuesday, Cassidy Hutchinson, a former aide to Trump, and his final chief of staff, Mark Meadows, appeared before the House January 6th committee for its sixth public hearing. Her extraordinary testimony spanned nearly 2 hours. In particularly striking passages, she described what she said or not told her was Trump's reaction to being told that after speaking to supporters at the Ellipse and telling a crowd he knew in part to be armed to fight like hell to overturn his election defeat, he could not go with the crowd to the U.S. Capitol as planned. To fight like hell, what is that supposed to mean? I mean, does it mean like in heart, mind, and spirit to save our nation from the Biden skyrocketing gasoline prices that he predicted would happen? or Trump's prediction that food and water shortages would appear and the shelves would start to empty out again and that the prices would skyrocket? Or that electricity would skyrocket and housing costs and that millions of illegals would be pouring into our country and that the American people would be forced to support them during a pandemic and during civil unrest and during what appears to be headed to hyperinflation. So Bill Gates buys up all the farmland and intends to create molecular meats and yummy, yummy. and all of his Monsanto genetically engineered foods, genetically engineered people, genetically engineered brains hooked up together and so forth from his own lips. Farmer Bill. So here we go. Trump allegedly told Engel, I'm the effing president. Take me up to the Capitol now. Really? I mean, I can't even go on. You can read this at The Guardian because it's so absurd. Wednesday, June 29th, 2022, it's dated. And it's entitled Secret Service Agent Reportedly Willing to Testify. Trump did not lunge at him. Still makes. I'm sorry, but that is so absurd. It just doesn't make any sense. So let's see real quick here. This little story here that will just set off your day. President Biden's administration invests $6 million of our taxes to advance racial equity in food stamp program. So why don't they just go get a job? What John Kerry said, you don't have a job anymore after the lockdowns, just go get a job. So now we're going to keep people on welfare who need to be getting off welfare, who need to be redeveloping their communities and creating jobs and better schools and raising themselves up by working outside of the home so that they can feel good about themselves and they can move up in the world. Food stamps only makes you a slave of your government. And, of course, we want people who are disabled, who are single moms and need a couple of years to get back on their feet, single dads, maybe the same, anyone who has health issues or elderly and can't make ends meet. Of course, we're all for it. God bless them. It's better than leaving the borders open and all the illegals from third world countries come first, and Americans' babies and children and the babies who didn't have formula, and the American kids and American adults come last under this administration. I hope you never forget that, because that isn't the American way. It is the anti-American way. And should never happen in the USA.
Obamasaurus, the new book by Rose M. Colombo, is an updated version of a political satire that reflects the political roadmap of today's world. Written with an Orwellian twist, will humanity survive or suffer depopulation or extinction? Obamasaurus by Rose M. Colombo, available at Amazon.com.
Well, my friends, time flies. And now is the time to say goodbye. Thanks so much for being part of the Colombo Chronicles family. You are appreciated. Please do it now. Bookmark. Push that like, share, and follow button. Oh, and don't forget to comment below and stay in touch. Make your family part of the Colombo family. Until next Wednesday at noon, remember, God loves you. And so does the Rose.